Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and you're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts. And this week, five ILR superstation licences are announced. BBC Radio Gloucestershire are booted off medium wave to a public outcry. The European community offer millions to prop up Mac. The UK says no. Satellite television without a dish. The death of the dinosaurs. All tennis radio from the All England Club in Wimbledon. The launch dates and prices of the first digital compact cassette and mini disc machines. And test transmissions of independent music radio announced the new national commercial rock station. That's starting on medium wave, and oh dear, 20% of Radio 1's listeners are still there, not listening to FM. Could they make an instant audience for independent music radio? We investigate. And how to tune into the space shuttle. This, plus lots more of your letters every week on Sparks from Radio Facts. We'll be right back.
Here's a headline in Asia Pacific Broadcasting claiming satellite television reception now possible without a dish. Satellite television broadcasts from Saudi Arabia, Egypt and India can now be received without a dish. Space and Scientific has launched a new S-band antenna capable of matching the performance of a 3.1 meter dish. The new Yagi antenna is easier to install, less susceptible to wind, and smaller than a conventional dish. The system consists of a dual Yagi antenna, LNB, and indoor receiver, and can give the same forward gain as found on a 3.1 meter dish antenna. For the lower signal areas of the ArabSat and InSat footprint, a phasing harness is available for four antennae. A press release from Space and Scientific says the whole system can be made operational within 10 to 15 minutes of unpacking. The Space and Scientific LNB is connected direct to the Yagi, and the antenna is pointed towards the satellite. The IF lead from the LNB is connected to the satellite receiver, which is in turn connected to the television. So goes the story in Asia Pacific Broadcasting, and that's not an April issue. Crown seeks to reduce French radio burden. Crown Communications, the radio broadcasting company that owns London's LBC station, is seeking to divest half of its interest in RFM, the French radio network that is threatening to pull the company under. The annual report and accounts reveals that Crown has so far invested £16 million in RFM, which plays classic rock music from more than 100 stations in France. Christopher Chataway, the Crown chairman, writes in his statement that the audience figures have yet to reflect this development, and advertising has followed more slowly than anticipated. Last year, RFM was responsible for nearly half of Crown's trading losses. Crown has capitalised £11 million worth of costs and losses under intangible assets on the balance sheet. The directors say this represents the value of RFM's main asset, a radio masthead. The report then goes on to outline the reservations of Pricewaterhouse, the auditors for Crown Communications, about the asset value of the company, and then ends with the comment that stripping out total intangible assets of £12.76 million, the net current liabilities of Crown are £5.1 million. The difficulties there of the owners of LBC, by Simon Pinkham in The Independent.
You're listening to Sparks on Radio Facts 3910, 6205 and 12255. Here's part of a longer article about the space shuttle in general, but it goes on to say how you can actually tune into the space shuttle frequencies. Whilst space shuttle launches are a fascinating spectacle, the fascination is enhanced further with the ability to monitor mission communications from liftoff to landing. This can be accomplished without the need to resort to a vast array of expensive receiving equipment. In fact, all that is needed is a single sideband HF radio and a long wire antenna. With such an arrangement, it would be possible to tune into the NASA relay station based at Ascension Island, which rebroadcasts two-way shuttle communications traffic and various briefings throughout non-military missions. In addition, the Goddard Space Center's amateur radio station, WA3NAN, provides a similar service on spot frequencies within the HF amateur radio bands. they are easily received in the UK. However, the greatest satisfaction by far for hardened space watchers is derived from receiving the orbiter direct, a possibility that's been brought to the general public through the wide availability of scanners. Whilst vital radio traffic is normally handled by the three TDRS satellites, UHF communications are maintained throughout and can be heard should the orbiter be passing over your part of the world. The minimum requirement for direct reception is an AM receiver that can be tuned into the VHF and UHF military allocation, and a crossed dipole aerial cut to the shuttle's operating frequencies. Having said this, the author did receive conversations from a recent mission with a vertical dipole cut to the airband wavelength, showing that anything's possible. Remember that on a direct reception basis, the shuttle can be heard only for a few minutes at a time when it passes above your location. The shuttle completes one orbit approximately every 90 minutes. A bit like our program. Anyway, the frequencies to listen out for the NASA relay are 20.198 MHz, 13.2 MHz, and for WA3NAN, 14.195 MHz, 21.295 MHz, and 28.650 MHz. And for the orbiter direct on 259.7 MHz, 270 MHz exactly, and 296.8 MHz. I'll repeat all them. The NASA relay frequencies are 20 meg, that's 20.198 to be exact, and 13.2 MHz. The WA3NAN amateur radio station is on 14.195 MHz, 21.295 MHz, and 28.650 MHz. And the orbiter can be heard in the VHF-UHF military band of 259.7 MHz, or 270.0 MHz, or 296.8 MHz, which the article lists is normally reserved for extravehicular activity, better known as spacewalking. Some fascinating information there in the latest Maplin magazine. On to a letter now from Philip Webster, who's in Woolton in Liverpool. I listen to your station on 6205. Reception is very good, with the exception of the occasional fading, generally on a par with the BBC World Service. My receiver is a Sharp four-wave band stereo twin cassette, WQ268E, with its own telescopic aerial. I find your programming both interesting and informative, and quite a refreshing change to other radio formats. I assume your programmes are on pre-recorded and repeated on a rotor system. Yes, until we can get a licence in the UK. We orbit the Earth, much like the space shuttle, at 90-minute intervals, and the other programmes are 2 hours long. Philip says, I can now hear you on 3910 as well. Thanks very much for writing in. And the same to Ron James, who's in Wellington, New Zealand. He's been listening on 12255 on an FRG8800 communications receiver. That's, of course, Yaesu, with an Oltec QF1A filter and an FRT77AA ATU and a 50-metre long wire aerial. He's at the Shag Valley Sheep Station, 50 miles north of the city of Dunedin in the South Island of New Zealand, which is also the site of the 1992 annual general meeting of the New Zealand DX Radio Association, whose headed notepaper he's using. And they have a DX weekend over the Easter period. He's got a report. And then a picture of the Shag Valley Sheep Station. My antenna runs from the rear of this building to the tall pine tree in the top right-hand corner. It's like a long outhouse with a corrugated roof. The car in the foreground belongs to a DXer, Dave Nairn, who also logged your broadcast and had better reception, as his antenna ran in a slightly different direction to mine. The van belongs to Ron Killick, who is chief editor of Tune In, our DX magazine. The car closest to the building belongs to Ali MacArthur, another DXer attending this meeting and DX weekend. Well, thanks, Ron, for writing in. Keep trying to pick us up on 6205, and happy shagging. So, Andy Cadier, has got some hints as to what's in the July issue of Shortwave Magazine's Pirate Radio page. The reasons why the Home Office will not license independent shortwave broadcasting. Other more convincing items, he writes, include Dutch medium wave pirates, the successful month of Caroline FM in Dover, and readers' reception reports, which is one of the reasons he's writing to me. Voluntary contributions from experienced pirate radio monitors are always welcome at Off the Record. 28 Romney Avenue, Folkestone in Kent, CT23QJ. So, if you'd like to contribute to the July issue of Off the Record in Shortwave Magazine, write to Andy Cadier. Off the Record, 28 Romney Avenue, Folkestone in Kent, CT23QJ with your pirate logs. And of course, I'm always looking forward to having your reports of what's on around the bands, FM, medium wave and shortwave. And our address, in case you don't know, is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And if you'd like a reply back with our station card and an information sheet including an artist's impression of the transmitter site, then please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. If you're just writing to say hello, then of course you don't need to send anything apart from your letter, of course. The address, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Well, apologies for all the address overload. I'll give you a rest now.
I never.
BBC Staff magazine a lament by the chief engineer of Radio Gloucestershire about the medium wave frequency, righting a wrong on the death of a wave. When Radio Gloucestershire went on the air 3 years ago, the Home Office made it clear that our medium wave frequency was temporary. Deregulation rules the waves these days, and the new incremental station serving Cheltenham Town Centre would be given our cherished 603 kHz, covering most of southern England and beyond. Medium waves are wonderful things. They reach parts of the country that others don't, permeating the chocolate box villages of the Cotswolds, hacking their way through the ancient oaks of the Royal Forest of Dean. Being the first local radio station to lose medium wave is no honour. If you're lucky, you get 6 months' notice, but it still comes as a shock. I imagine the transmitter engineer in a black hood wielding an axe. Instead, the familiar anorak-clad figure arrived, and at the flick of a switch, we lost 35% of our audience. It came at a time when we doubled our listening figures. The local commercial station, free from franchise constraints and split into two, had gone the way of many others, and we'd established ourselves as the station to turn to for local news and information. We'd prepared carefully. On-air trails, television promotions, newspapers, FM competitions, split cartridges, car stickers. It's amazing how many things had 603 on them. Stationery, mugs, t-shirts, radio car, van, the hoarding at Gloucester Rugby Club, all had to be changed. Oh, and of course, there was the leaflet campaign. I suggested that the leaflet should have a cartoon figure who would demonstrate pictorially how to tune in to FM. Someone said we should call him Roy the Retuner. So, courtesy of graphics at Bristol, he was born. Looking rather like a flabby sausage, he was christened Captain Condom by the staff, bemused looks from my 13-year-old daughter. The leaflets were delivered to the FM audience, and our engineering FM helpline sprang into action. Hello, is that Roy the Retuner? Engineering information arrived in force, manning the phones, running the roadshow. Day one produced 300 calls, 1,000 in the first week. Our live broadcasts from police headquarters took on a new meaning. The chief superintendent in charge of communications explained that they were now broadcasting traffic information to motorists who couldn't hear us. At Shire Hall, the County Disasters and Emergencies Committee wanted to know where we could now be heard. We sent them a blotchy map. The middle bit was okay. We could broadcast flood warnings along the Severn Vale. The high ground either side was definitely out. If your school's closed by snow, you'll have to trust your luck to the commercial station. Then the letters arrived. Some were angry. Dear sir, congratulations, you've achieved what Hitler never managed, deprived us of our BBC radio. Some were sad. I feel devastated. I've met your friend. You never even said goodbye. Some people just had to be visited. A colonel, for example, who said he was a personal friend of the chairman and half the board of BBC Governors. Good morning, Colonel. I'm Captain Mr. Priest from the BBC. The visit was 50% successful. The hi-fi worked after moving the aerial, but the colonel complained about the modern portable in the kitchen, a valve-operated Bakelite job which doubled as a toaster. It was a lost cause. At Tetbury Town Council, there was a strange smell. The tenant on the floor above the council office was having problems with the loo. Stepping over the drain rods, I suggested that we held the meeting on the pavement. You do realise, Mr. Priest, that Charles lives just down the road. Did I recollect a call from Highgrove? And what about my six tractors? All their radios are medium wave. We used to rely on you for the weather. The crowd grew larger, and we were moved on by the police. Cotswold District Council next. Councillor Smith could receive radios Wales, Bedfordshire, Oxfordshire, CWR, Derby, but not a glimmer of Radio Gloucestershire. Why should they give us free studio accommodation at Cirencester when most of the Cotswolds couldn't hear us? I explained propagation, frequencies, radio communications agency, DTI, and emerged shaken but unscathed. We kept our studio. They would lobby the new Member of Parliament. Meanwhile, over in the forest, after talking to the Women's Institute, the Rotary Club, and two more town councils, I arrived at Mrs. Jones's. The door opened slowly, and the lady appeared, bent double with arthritis. On the lace-covered table, in the one room she used in her tiny cottage, was an old Grundig portable. The aerial had never been used. After some fiddling, a faint but recognisable Radio Gloucestershire jingle was heard. For a brief moment, Mrs. Jones sat upright, and holding back the tears, said simply, "Thank you, Mr. Priest." Radio couldn't get more local. The loss of medium wave coverage by BBC Radio Gloucester, described there by Roy Priest, engineer in charge of BBC Radio Gloucestershire, in Aerial, the BBC staff magazine.
So with BBC Radio Gloucester leaving medium wave, soon to appear there will be Independent Music Radio. A look at that now by Michael Kavanagh from Broadcast magazine. Independent Music Radio, winner of the second national commercial radio licence, is to delay its launch until next year, despite earlier indications that an autumn 92 launch was likely. A statement issued recently by the Radio Authority confirmed that it had formally granted the national licence to the joint venture by TVAM and Virgin, after approving its funding arrangements. But the station also confirmed that the national medium wave rock station had opted for a launch in spring 93 rather than early launch this year. Virgin Communications chairman Robert Devereux had previously stated that either date was possible, but many observers had assumed that IMR would be on air by the end of the year. However, listeners should get an early taste of IMR output, as the period between now and the on-air launch date will be punctuated by test transmissions of IMR's proposed programming material, said the Radio Authority. The decision to delay means that Classic FM is likely to steal a march of several months over IMR, with its plans to be on air by the autumn. So there's something to listen out for, test transmissions from Independent Music Radio on the old Radio 3 frequencies of 1197 and 1215 medium wave. And turning to Radio 1 now, Johnny Beerling is concerned that more than one-fifth of the station's 15 million listeners have not yet responded to the long-running campaign to get them to switch to the FM frequency. They will be vulnerable to the lure of INR2, which may launch as early as autumn. Well, that's reported from The Independent. We now know that's not true. The first national commercial competition for Radio 1. Since losing its medium wave frequency last year, Radio 2's audience has dropped from 11 million to 9 million. Like Radio 1, it faces fierce competition this year from Classic FM, the national commercial classical station. So there you are, one-fifth of Radio 1's listeners still listening on AM will be an instant audience for Independent Music Radio, quite possibly. And remember, test transmissions on 1197 and 1215.
Diamond Storm ended dinosaur era in the world's worst weekend. The dinosaurs perished in a dust storm of tiny diamonds from outer space, according to Canadian scientists. David Brez-Carlisle of Environment Canada reports in the journal Nature that diamonds measured in billionths of a metre found at a geological boundary between the Cretaceous and Tertiary periods, a sudden boundary formed 65 million years ago, were of extraterrestrial origin. This is no surprise. In 1989, Chicago scientists confirmed not only the findings of diamonds in meteorites, but also hypothesized that there were billions of them floating in interstellar space. But the latest report adds a little more glitter to the asteroid theory of dinosaur extinction. This is that all the huge lizards which roamed the globe for more than 100 million years perished suddenly when an asteroid 5 miles across and weighing 500 billion tons crashed into the Earth at 25 miles a second somewhere near Yucatan in Mexico. At this speed, the nitrogen and oxygen in the atmosphere would have burst into flames, turning into nitric acid. The impact would have caused colossal tidal waves, darkened the skies with its own dust, creating a nuclear winter in which temperatures fell so low that the planet's forests suddenly freeze-dried. At the first burst of lightning, these would then have burst into flame. Meanwhile, the nitric acid from the heavens would have leached cadmium, lead, and mercury from the rocks into the water supplies. So, the dinosaurs would have been pulverized, frozen, incinerated, gassed, drowned, and poisoned. Global warming and ozone depletion might also have been part of the overkill. Paleontologists who claim to have uncovered evidence for all this have dubbed it the worst weekend in the history of the world. There are other theories. Many scientists say volcanic eruptions can explain it all. But the discovery of extraterrestrial diamonds in the same layer lends more weight to the Big Bang hypothesis. It may not have been an asteroid, though, argues Dr. Carlisle. It seems more likely to have been a comet from the remote outer solar system. Science editor of The Guardian, Tim Radford, there describing how dinosaurs could have met their rather unpleasant end.
And a letter now from Mr. C. Rowland, who's in South Malton in North Devon. He says, can we supply a copy of the World Radio TV Handbook? Well, not directly, no, but it's not that difficult to get hold of. It's published by Billboard for around £20, and any bookshop will order it for you. So, World Radio TV Handbook, which is a very useful guidebook. In fact, I referred to it just now when I couldn't remember for the life of me what the old Radio 3 frequencies were, and I went and looked them up in my old copy. It also lists said schedule of all shortwave broadcast stations, although we're not in there. So, sorry, we can't help there, Mr. Rowland. And Yara Sedlar writes in from Brno in Czechoslovakia with a postcard with five different architectural delights from that city. 12255, he picked up Pink Floyd music, which had to be Radio Fax and Sparks, didn't it? ATS 803A is his radio with a 20 metre long wire. Thanks for that card, Yara Sedlar in Czechoslovakia. And in Burford in Oxfordshire, it's Mr. E.J. Giles, who says, I hear and appreciate your programme when I find the time on those long spring days. I hope you can stay on the air. I hear you on 6205 daytime and 3910 after dark when the signal comes in loud and clear for most of the time. I've heard your 12-something, 12255 wavelength, to be exact, once. I think it was probably freak conditions. Yep, quite right. Well done, Mr. E.J. Giles. And you'll be getting your reply very soon.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green, towering over your head. Look for the girl with the sun in her eyes, and she's gone. Lucy! People eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore, waiting to take you. Plasticine pauses with looking glass ties. Suddenly someone is there at the turnstile, the girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
Philips DC-777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC-777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM-FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard-sized car radio unit. AM, FM, and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shelving list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67VG in England.
Sweet attraction of a silent tape. When you next slot a cassette into the car stereo and turn up the sound, take a moment to think of Dr. George Tomka and his colleagues. For you may be getting better sound quality, more cheaply, out of both tape and speakers, thanks to the research his team has been conducting in the cramped basement rooms of Lancashire Polytechnic in Preston. Dr. Tomka, a temporary lecturer in the Polytechnic's Department of Physics and Astronomy, is interested in permanent magnets. So is the European Community, which has been funding a research program into them known as Concerted European Action on Magnets since the early 80s. The SEAM program has brought together more than 120 scientists and engineers from nearly 60 laboratories across the European Community to probe the properties of new magnetic materials. Dr. Tomka's colleagues have focused on the magnetic materials deposited on cassette and videotapes. They are listening to the noise on magnetic tapes, the unwanted random background that can degrade sound quality on a cassette or destroy digitally recorded data. One result of this research may be the development of audio tapes that produce a purer sound, and of computer tapes and floppy disks that can store data at even higher densities than is now possible. This aspect of the group's work is supported in part by 3M, a company with a significant stake in manufacturing magnetic tapes and disks. Since about 1985, according to Dr. Tomka, the best material available for making permanent magnets has been a ceramic, a mixture of neodymium, iron, and boron. Its main rival is a samarium cobalt mixture. The traditional way of processing ceramics has been sintering. The powdered mixture is fired to a very high temperature in a furnace. A clever alternative is melt spinning, where Dr. Tomka says you bung the powders into a crucible, apply radio frequency heating, and then extrude the product onto the rim of a metal wheel. The wheel is continuously cooled, allowing the magnetic material to be taken off in the form of a thin ribbon. What prompted the European Commission to set up SEEM was that it seemed in the early 80s as though Europe was losing out in technology essential to our electric and electronic age. The Americans had patented the sintering process for making the new magnets, and the Japanese patented the melt spinning route. Sintered magnets are widely used in small electric motors, but their ceramic materials are hard to form and work. The melt-spun magnets can be bonded with polymers, such as nylon, making them much easier to work with. Depending on the polymer you bond it with, you can melt and mold the magnet at around 200 degrees centigrade. The largest market for polymer-bonded magnets is car door loudspeakers. Despite the importance of these materials and their wide application in industrial and domestic uses, researchers are only now beginning to understand the basic reasons why they make such good magnets. This improved understanding should allow researchers either to improve the efficiency of the materials or to develop alternatives that might serve as still better magnets. Schoolchildren have traditionally turned iron nails into permanent magnets by stroking them repeatedly in the same direction with one pole of a bar magnet. This repeated application of an external magnetic field orients internal magnetic domains within the iron nail in the same direction, leaving a residual magnetism. Turning high-tech ceramics into magnets is much more sophisticated in detail, but basically similar in principle. Powerful electromagnets are used to generate the external magnetic field to align the internal domains. Dr. Tomka is interested in measuring the remnants of these materials. This is the residual magnetism after the external fields have been switched off. The neodymium iron boron material is easy to magnetize, but hard to demagnetize, which is, of course, just the property that makes them ideal for permanent magnets. This desirable characteristic arises because of the interactions between magnetic domains and the grains of material that make up the ceramics. Dr. Tomka's work should help lead to a better understanding of this type of interaction and thus to better permanent magnets. Remnants measurements also feature in the work of Dr. Tomka's colleagues, Dr. Mohsen Aghi and Mike Clark, who are examining the magnetic coating on cassette and videotapes. Unwanted noise results from interactions between clusters of grains on the tape. The frequency of the noise indicates the range of the interaction. The work is being done in collaboration with researchers at other institutes, and the group hopes to move on to examine noise on the magnetic coatings of computer floppy disks. One factor limiting how much information can be packed onto a disk is the strength of the interaction between the grains of magnetic material, because at high densities this interaction can corrupt data written onto the disk. That was by Tom Wilkie in The Independent.
This week on Sparks, 5 ILR superstation licences are announced. BBC Radio Gloucestershire are booted off medium wave to a public outcry. The European Community offer millions to prop up Mac as used on BSkyB, and the UK says no. Satellite TV without a dish? The death of the dinosaurs? All tennis radio from the All England Club in Wimbledon, the launch dates and prices of the first DCC and mini disc machines, and test transmissions of independent music radio announced, the new national commercial rock station, due to start on medium wave. And oh dear, 20% of Radio 1's listeners are still there. Could they be an instant audience? Also, how to tune into the space shuttle. All later on this week in Sparks. So, the European Community gives a thumbs up to £590 million for high-definition television. European Commissioner Filippo Pandolfi has fired the starting gun on a $1 billion cash bonanza designed to deliver widescreen advanced television services into most European homes by mid-1990, the mid-1990s. Pandolfi has won EC approval for an action plan to give 850 million ECUs, or £590 million of European taxpayers' money, to programme makers, broadcasters, satellite operators and cable network owners to help them get new widescreen TV channels off the ground. By 1996, the aim is to have at least 30 satellite TV services broadcasting 16:9 format pictures in either the improved definition D2 Mac or high definition HD Mac transmission standards, with a total of 26,000 hours of EC supported program material on tape. In a move likely to create an early stampede for cash, the plan proposes to give out most of the money in the first 2 years of the five-year programme. The idea is to encourage companies to bring services on stream as soon as possible. The lion's share of the cash, some 460 million ECUs, is earmarked for subsidising transmission costs, including encoding and encryption services, and the cost of satellite uplinks and transponder rental. 60 million ECUs will be spent on upgrading TV studios, 220 million ECUs on programme production and the conversion of existing material to the new format, and 110 million ECUs on upgrading cable networks. Rather than funding individual companies, the plan proposes to give cash to consortia of firms that cover the entire TV service chain, from programme production to final distribution. Pandolfi's scheme still has to clear the hurdle of the Council of Ministers, probably at a meeting of telecoms ministers in June, where each minister has the power to veto the scheme. In the past, the UK government has opposed EC subsidies to promote the Mac TV standard. And in a more recent article, that's come true. Britain's TV industry has turned its nose up at the offer of millions of pounds of European Community cash to establish widescreen television services based on the Mac standard. The proposal to hand out 850 million ECUs in subsidies was given the thumbs down by TV companies, satellite TV firms, cable TV operators and other interested groups at a meeting with DTI ministers last Wednesday. According to industry sources, the mood at the meeting was against any subsidy of Mac-based TV, preferring to leave it to the market to decide between Mac and other systems such as PAL Plus or digital TV systems. This increases the chances of a British veto of the scheme at a meeting of telecommunication ministers in June. Technology Minister Edward Lee described the subsidy as absurd. The government is prepared to consider a proposal for a considerably lesser sum supported by a rigorous business case. We have not seen such a case. Those reports in Electronics Weekly. Seems very surprising that all these TV companies and cable TV operators have turned down all this cash. I wonder how much of it is leaning on by the British government, which of course hates subsidy of any kind. They prefer to leave it to the market forces. Surprising results there, but it's seeming increasingly likely that some sort of digital high-definition television service seems sensible, as the technology is virtually there, and what with increases in developments in
digital compression algorithms seemingly by the month. Digital HDTV seems almost there, and it would be a shame, really, to have a Mac standard, which is still based on an analog HDTV format.
The Office of Fair Trading looks at advertising rates of Capital Radio. Topaz Amor writes in The Independent. Capital, the London commercial radio station that has long been the most profitable in the independent sector, is one of several firms whose advertising rates are being informally investigated by the Office of Fair Trading. The OFT is interested in the practice of offering discounts to advertisers who agree not to advertise on rival stations, because it feels competition is likely to be damaged. Capital, whose two wavelengths reach 4 out of 10 Londoners each week, is facing increased competition for listeners and advertising revenue from newer London stations such as Kiss, Melody and Jazz FM. Under the Competition Act 1980, the OFT can carry out investigations into any conduct that prevents, restricts or distorts competition. If this is proved, the case can be passed to the Monopolies and Mergers Commission.
Well, I don't know about you, but that sounds like unfair trading to me by Capital Radio. Anyway, on to a letter by Mr. R. Coutts, who's in Milton Keynes. I enclose a letter from Paul Watt of Radio Merlin. Ross Coutts says, keep up the good work with Sparks. And I'll read out Paul Watt's letter now. Please can you give us a mention over the air in our fight for free radio, as you probably know about our raid on the 23rd of December. We are low on funds and are trying for legal aid, but it does not seem very promising to keep the station going. It is costing me £40 a week, and that is for 8 hours on Sunday. With the cost of legal help, we can't keep the service going for long. We have got some t-shirts for sale to help towards the legal costs, available in all sizes. They're £5 each, and he encloses some designs, which are quite reasonable. So £5 for a Radio Merlin t-shirt, including Radio Caroline, remember the raid, with a very evil-looking giant with an axe, and a pirate person, Radio Merlin, Europe's premier music station. Also, Paul says, if anyone would be interested in doing programmes, it will cost £5 an hour to help keep us going. And you can advertise what you like in your hour, as long as you pay £5. So the address for a Radio Merlin t-shirt, or to contact them generally, is Radio Merlin International, P.O. Box 1218, Chelmsford, Essex, CM1, 4BD. That's P.O. Box 1218, Chelmsford, Essex, CM1, 4BD. Paul goes on to say the DTI are throwing the book at us and using us as an example or test case. He says we can beat them if we can keep our solicitor. We didn't get much support at court and we need it badly. We're back in court on the 4th of August at 11 o'clock in the morning. Anybody that's interested in free radio would be very welcome, because we need the support. And he says if we win, anybody can broadcast from the UK without a licence until they change the law. That's a very hopeful letter from Paul Watt, but he does need any help you can give him. Paul appeared on Tuesday the 5th of May at Chelmsford Magistrates Court. It was here he was charged with three offences against the 1991 Broadcasting Act. The first was broadcasting without a licence, the second was allowing his property to be used for illegal broadcasts, and the third was for damaging government property, because he smashed up one of his tape recorders just after they'd seized it, so the story goes. So that's his three counts he's been charged with, only expecting a few charges, he was amazed at the list reeled off. But still he denied each one, claiming his innocence. DTI officials present were bewildered by what they heard from the Merlin manager, saying that they had actually caught him red-handed running the station back on December the 23rd. Officials became angry at what they heard from Paul, and so began stressing the seriousness of the laws he'd broken. They said that the station, along with many other pirates, had been using a frequency allocated to the Ministry of Defence, who the prosecutor alleged used frequencies from 6200 to 6600. If this is true, why is it that legal stations Radio Vaticana and the Voice of Hope, who broadcast in between these frequencies, were not up in front of the magistrates? Paul pleaded not guilty to everything. He was let free, but only just, as he could quite easily have been held on remand. Scary thought for being involved in pirate radio. He'd have been in prison for about 2 months without being proven guilty. It will not now be until August the 4th from 11 o'clock at Chelmsford Magistrates Court that the station's future will be calculated, as Paul will be back in court then. That's what Pirate Chat had to say about that, and they repeat the asks for help and the T-shirt offer and so on. Now, on Sunday the 21st of June, it's the 5th annual radio boot sale from Newbury and District Amateur Radio Society. That's from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m. at Ackland Hall and Recreation Fields, Cold Ash, Newbury, Berkshire. That's off the M4 if you take Junction 13 down the A34 to Newbury, and then you follow the signpost to Thatcham, and then you turn left and go 1.9 miles down to Cold Ash. It's off the M4 Junction 13, follow the A34 to Newbury, then follow the A4 to Thatcham, and then follow the signs to Cold Ash, which is left out of Thatcham. And it's £7 a pitch, pay on the day. And the phone number for contacting them is 0635 863 310 or 0635 46241. That's for the Newbury Amateur Radio Society boot sale on Sunday the 21st of June.
Holiday snaps make TV debut in the Financial Times. Another milestone in the onward march of multimedia will be passed in September with the worldwide launch of Kodak's much-trumpeted photo CD system. Conversion of 35mm photographs to digital images for display on televisions or personal computers. By then, 2 years will have passed since Kodak announced the system, but William Jack, Vice President for Worldwide Electronic Imaging Systems and Consumer Imaging, stresses the US company has not been twiddling its thumbs. What was a concept based on an intensive 18-month effort, pulling together all the technologies within Kodak, has become a product, with the help of know-how and hardware from outside the company. In the intervening period, Kodak has been talking to software suppliers, hardware manufacturers, and systems integrators to establish the photo CD standard. There are no obstacles to the broadest participation by photographic and consumer electronics companies in this one standard, says Jack. The consumer wishing to playback photos, new or old, via photo CD will be able to choose between three Kodak photo CD players manufactured by Philips in Belgium. But the discs and players will be widely available through the licensing of Kodak software and the photo CD trademark. You'll be able to read Fuji photo CD on a disc, and all our photographic competitors will be aboard at the outset. For the computer market, which Jack sees as equally important and in many cases overlapping, the ease of access and use of photo CD is particularly important and is being addressed through Kodak's Photo CD Access Development Toolkit and software. Kodak's discussions have been helped by the computer industry's need for something new to boost flagging revenues. In the high street, photographers will be able to pay £4.99 for a special photo CD disc and £7.95 for having 24 exposures written digitally onto it. Further exposures can be added up to a maximum of 100. The Kodak photo CD players will cost £299, £369 and £429 in the UK and can also play audio CDs. Ravi Khanna, the UK product manager for Photo CD, believes the mid-priced model, which has extra functions such as zoom, crop, and rotate, will prove the most popular. The Kodak system, along with other adventures into multimedia, has inevitably raised questions about consumer reaction. The advantage of the Kodak system is the simplicity of the system and the fact that the camera itself and the routine visits to high street kiosks to get the film developed is unaffected. Whether consumers will pay to watch still pictures via photo CD players when they could watch moving pictures via camcorders remains to be seen. Jack is increasingly confident that they will, but Kodak has also been careful to future-proof its investment. The picture quality is four times the standard that will be required for high-definition television. That was by Andrew Bagster.
And news of the other big consumer technology releases this year, DCC and Minidisc. Polygram all announced a list of musicians, featuring Bryan Adams, U2 and the Fine Young Cannibals, and Pavarotti and Von Karajan, who from the classical world, whose music would be available on digital compact cassette when the system is launched in September. The company plans to have about 500 music titles ready when DCC systems become available. The pricing of pre-recorded music on the new digital cassettes has been an important issue in the industry, and one which many observers believe will be a key factor determining the success or failure of DCC. And Sony, the Japanese consumer electronics group, said yesterday it planned to introduce its first mini-disc portable player, a miniaturized version of the compact disc, in Japan by November the 1st, and in main overseas markets by Christmas. The mini-disc is competing against the DCC as the next generation recording system, with the audio quality of the compact disc. Sony, which is seeking a new popular product to reverse its fall in earnings for 1991, hopes the mini-disc will repeat the success of its Walkman cassette player, with the mini-disc replacing cassettes in the same way that the CD has succeeded the long-playing record. Exactly the same thing Philips want for their DCC. The mini disc will be the first CD system able to record as well as play. Sony said it would price the mini disc at 80,000 yen. That's about $617 for a record and playback model, and 60,000 yen for a playback only version. Pre-recorded mini-disc albums would cost about the same as CD albums, which is about 2,500 yen in Japan, while blank discs could be about 1,000 yen, which is about £5. Matsushita recently announced it would market its first DCC player in Japan on September the 21st. The DCC table unit would be priced at 135,000 yen. A portable DCC player is scheduled to be launched next spring at a lower price. The DCC technology was developed by Philips of the Netherlands. Analysts believe that the mini disc may have gained a competitive edge over the DCC, at least in the Japanese market, because of its lower price and its compact disc format. The failure of digital audio tape indicates that consumer interest in the use of cassette tape is waning, while the preference for compact discs is growing, says Mr. Chuck Goto, an analyst at SG Warburg Securities. The price of the mini disc must still fall further to penetrate the mass market, he adds. However, Mr. Barry Dargan, deputy head of research at James Capel in Tokyo, believes there is still consumer resistance to both the mini-disc and DCC systems, with the most popular alternative being a recordable standard-size compact disc. The advantage with the mini-disc is that at least it's a step in that direction. Those reports in the Financial Times by Mikio Nakamoto and John Burton, both in Tokyo. And thanks to Ron Prosser for sending the contributions from Broadcast Magazine. And also from that magazine, Super ILR Frequencies on the Spring List by Matt Baker. Licenses for five new local radio superstations could be awarded by the Radio Authority next spring, subject to frequency clearance. The authority has committed itself to a tight timetable for getting the new regional services up and running. It will advertise the five licenses covering the Northeast, the Northwest, West Midlands, the Severn Estuary and Central Scotland in September or October of this year. Applicants will have 3 months to submit bids, and the licence winners should be known early in 1993. The five regional stations will have to offer a radically different programming format from other independent stations in their area. Current ILR licence holders can only apply if they give up existing contracts. The authority has quashed speculation that one applicant might win new licenses to form a network. Radio Authority Chief Executive Peter Baldwin said he was optimistic about getting frequency clearance for the new stations later this year and of seeing them on air by autumn 1993. Well, it doesn't say there whether they're AM or FM, but new frequency clearance implies, I suppose, that they're FM. So that's the North East, the North West, West Midlands, the Severn Estuary and Central Scotland. You could be seeing new stations within a year. And just how radical will some of the programme proposals to be different from the current ILRs in that area? And I wonder if we'll get our first country station, something people have been muttering about for some years. And don't forget the crop circle making competition. For 12 years, elaborately swirled crop formations have been appearing in crops in England and elsewhere. The Cereologist magazine, the journal for crop circle studies, is promoting a contest for making corn circles to be held on the night of the 11th and 12th of July 1992. Richard Adams, our author of Watership Down and the Cereologist's editor, hopes that the hoaxers who have recently claimed to be responsible for many of the formations will demonstrate their skills in public. A field of barley has been set aside for the competition and is under cultivation at a secret site in southern England. A first prize of £3,000 and runner-up awards is offered for the artificial crop formation which best reproduces the features observed at crop circle sites. The judges include Richard Adams, Rupert Sheldrake, author of Rebirth of Nature and well-known crop circle expert, John Mitchell, author and regular contributor to The Oldie, and farmer Montague Keane. After the event, the site's location will be disclosed and the public will be invited to view the results. Teams of circle makers with or without previous experience are invited to apply for entry. Details and entry forms from Crop Circle Making Contest, The Guardian, 119 Farringdon Road, London, EC1R3ER, and please enclose a stamped addressed envelope. The competition is sponsored by PM Magazine, the Kostler Foundation and Environment Guardian. So the address again, Crop Circle Making Contest, The Guardian, 119 Farringdon Road, London, EC1R3ER.
I found the bike, you can ride it if you like it. Go to the bus, hit the bell, and bring some things to make it look good. I'd give it to you if I could, but I borrowed it. You're the kind of girl that fits in with my world. I'll give you anything, everything, if you want things. Let's go.
Time to listen to ex-Caroline presenter Dave Asher.
Time to phone a new satellite venture called Euronet, which started, as we predicted, on the Astra 1B satellite, Sky Sports transponder, subcarrier 7.56 megahertz. But a couple of weeks back, the very same transponder was active with a station called World Radio Network. Speaking from central London, Dave Asher, program controller of Euronet, says they're completely different, having an offshore connection with Radio Caroline.
Well, Euronet isn't the same as World Radio Network, and we're a completely different organisation to them. We've basically a group of Radio Caroline people, and the idea is to have a music radio station that plays good old rock and roll, and in the meantime, you know, in those times that aren't taken up with the rock and roll, we will sell off directly to other people who can take maybe 1 hour, 2 hours a day, or maybe 2 hours a week even, yeah? So in the evening or overnight, the time will be sold off to subsidize the music. And the music station that appears on the transponder on the satellite will in fact not be called Euronet. It'll be called something completely different, but we'll know more about that when we get there.
Talk Talk and the song Living in Another World from the album The Colour of Spring from 1985 that time. You're on Euronet Audio 7.56 megahertz on the Astra satellite with Sky Sports. 071-613-1101. That's the number to call if you'd like to say hello.
Hello, I'm listening from a very, very, very far away place.
If you want to say that, or if you want to say, yeah, play as a record, that's the number to call, 071-613-1101.
The channel hasn't been active at all times this past week. That's because the studio link from central London to Sky Television on the outskirts of the capital hasn't been installed yet. So what are we hearing at the moment?
It's basically a tape that's running from Sky itself. The videotape lasts for 8 hours and technically should go three times in any day, obviously 3/8 to 24. And when the tape runs out, it rewinds back to the beginning and should start again. But for some reason, sometimes it doesn't start again. Sky are looking into that.
You mentioned Radio Caroline, but I mean Caroline, the ship itself, is sitting in Dover, isn't it?
That's right, yes, the ship's sitting in Dover. Part of this station's management used to be involved in Caroline, used to be part of the ship and everything. I was there for a long time myself, as were quite a few others. And all the DJs that we have now working on our station, on Euronet, they're all ex-Caroline DJs. So basically the idea was originally to, you know, to go to the relevant people and say, you know, we could put you on the satellite, you know, come with us. But they didn't want to go for that. We're still talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if they decide that they want to do it, then of course we'll be more than happy to sort of go ahead and call the thing Caroline, and certain bits will be sold off and they'll be the Euronet.
But as you can hear at the moment, there's some dispute within the Caroline organisation as to whether the offshore days are really over. Euronet say they'll continue testing, and their address is simply P.O. Box 1234, London N16XH in England.
That story on Media Network with Jonathan Marks.
All tennis radio station just for the fans. In the Evening Standard, Paul Chesterton writes, the first all-tennis radio station will take to the air at this year's Wimbledon, catering for the avid fan and those who want to simply avoid the crush. Radio Wimbledon will broadcast up to 4 miles on 101.6 FM, with a potential audience of nearly 500,000. It will provide news and weather information between match commentaries by leading British coaches and players including Andrew Castle, Sue Mapp, and Paul Hutchins. Those inside the ground will be able to tune in on special headphones, but it will also appeal to Wimbledon residents who hate the game by providing information on how to avoid the worst queues, traffic jams and general disruption. The first programme starts at 8 a.m. on the 22nd of June, direct from the All England Club. Broadcasting will continue 14 hours a day throughout the fortnight. Funded by the club with no sponsorship or advertising, the station will be run by Landon Brown Associates, who also manage a similar service for the Le Mans 24-hour motor race and other radio stations for golf and sailing. Executive producer Larry Hodgson is returning to the studio 12 months after retiring as head of BBC Radio Sport and Outside Broadcasts. He said it's very much a town and ground concept, helping to bond with the local community, and I believe it is particularly important to help out those trying to avoid the pretty heavy disruption during the fortnight. John Curry, chairman of the All England Club, said the new radio service would continue every year if it proved to be the success he anticipated. That's 101.6 in Wimbledon for a month. And over the last year, there have been an Asian station in Wimbledon using 101.6, and I've been able to hear this here, and Trevor's heard that down where he is, so it's quite possible we'll be able to pick up this Radio Wimbledon where we are, which is significantly further away than 4 miles, and I'll bring you a bit of that in a few weeks. A letter now from Russia. Alexei Osipov, who's in St. Petersburg, which used to be Leningrad. Shows you a thing or two calling it St. Petersburg. And he says, I'd like to inform you that St. Petersburg DX Club is going to prepare a set of several radio programmes devoted to free radio, or so-called pirates, for listeners in Russia. Hopefully they will be broadcast via Radio Polis, a local station in St. Petersburg, both on medium wave and short wave. Naturally, Radio Caroline will be the first in our story. I suppose Russian audience would also be interested in knowing more about Radio Facts. So we've sent them some information about Radio Facts. If there's anyone listening from any of the other shortwave free radio stations who'd like to contact him, then it's Alexei Osipov at Kazanskaya 4-87, St. Petersburg 195213 in Russia, and he's even giving a telephone number, 812/221-0198. Or if you didn't catch all that, you can send anything to go to him via us at the usual address. And he reported listening to us on 3910 and has given some programme details. That's the president of St. Petersburg DX Club, Alexei Osipov, writing in.
head when I look to the west, and my spirit is crying for leaving. In my thoughts I have seen rings of smoke through the trees, and the voices of those who stand looking.
We'll be right back. to heaven.
Now, an appeal for information about Daventry during the war. It appears in the BBC staff magazine, Ariel, and the letter starts off with a reference to the G navigation chain system, which was at Daventry during the war. This was a pulse navigation system for use by aircraft, and it transmitted around the 75 megahertz region. The navigation station was designated RAF station number 7111, type 7000 Eastern Chain. It was the master station to the Eastern G chain, and its mandate was to provide a 24-hour service. It was formed in April 1941 and operated until December 1, 1957. RAF personnel were accommodated with the Army at Weedon until September 1948, when they moved to their own base at Staverton, now a USAF radio link. The unit became number 699 Signals Unit in 1952. A farewell dinner for the unit was held at the Plough and Bell Hotel on December 6, 1957. No doubt many Daventryites will, like me, wonder where they put them all. The old Plough and Clangor was not the most spacious of establishments. I am currently researching the unit, together with the Air Met service, and the operation of its transmitter for communication purposes. If anyone could provide me with any more information about any of the above, I'm particularly interested in the aerial system and its layout, I would be most grateful. So, if you have any information, get in touch with Brian G. Porter, 7 Goldsmith Street, Mansfield, NG18, 5PF.
Tim Bucknell writes in from Congleton in Cheshire. I've received your station on 3910, 6205 and 12255. I can only receive 12255 in the afternoons. I very much enjoy your programmes, which I listen to on my Sony ICF 2001D. On the air, you asked people to send in lists of local free radio stations. The nearest ones to me are from Merseyside, 100 MHz KISS FM, and 1296 kHz on AM, medium wave, North Coast Radio, now silent, 6232 Concept Radio, and 1350 North Coast Radio, also now silent, and 105.35 Energy FM. And from Manchester, he mentions 101.2 Radio 101 FM, and 104.4 IVC Radio, and something from the Midlands, 6260 NAF FM, and also on 100.7. I've also received some code number stations, which I've listed on the back of the letter. If you have any idea as to their purpose, let me know. Well, the expert on that is the author of the number stations book. However, I'll read out these so you can listen out for them. 3230, a German station at 1950 UTC. 3370, also in German, it's 1708 UTC. 3910, the English station on at 2046 UTC. 4010 kHz, a German station on at 2212 UTC. 5012, a German station at 1739 UTC. 5015, also a German station. And 5370 in German on at 1950. At 6235, there's a German station, which I've heard. That's on at 1509. At 6270, an English station on at 1915 UTC. He also lists number stations on 6507, 6911, 6933, 7375, 7404, 7584, 11415 and 3149.7. Keep up the good work, says Tim Bucknell, who also says he's writing to his MP. Good for you.